Hello, and welcome to Awin Talks, the affiliate and partner marketing podcast. I'm your host, Rob Davidson, head of content over here at Awin, and thanks for joining us today. So I'm finally back after a three-month hiatus thanks to extended paternity leave, and it already feels like I was never away. Now, I want to give a quick shout out to both of my colleagues, Lee and Sam, who kept the pod going while I was off. And I have to say, I really enjoyed their episodes on brand partnerships and MarTech, which genuinely kept me entertained in the middle of the night while I was trying to convince a two-month-old to go back to sleep. So if you missed those episodes, do go back and check them out. Now, on this month's podcast, I had a chance to speak to Benedict Evans, a tech industry analyst who gave the keynote presentation at this year's Awin Think Tank conference in the UK back in May. Now, I'm a huge fan of Benedict's work personally, and I can highly recommend his newsletter and podcast as really insightful resources for understanding more about the general direction of the wider tech landscape, really. His Think Tank keynote definitely didn't disappoint and was jam-packed with a huge number of charts, graphs, and really interesting takes on how the space is evolving right now. In fact, it was so packed that I think the very first audience question that came up on Slido at the very end was simply, can you summarize what just happened? And that's kind of what I'm hoping you'll get from my conversation with Benedict today. For those of you that were at the event, this is another chance to hear more about his talk as I get him to expand upon a few of the points that he made during it. While for those of you that weren't, this is a great taster and introduction of what was presented on the day. After our conversation, I'll do a quick roundup of some recent news and updates here at Awin. But for now, let's jump straight into my conversation with Benedict. Hi, Benedict. Thanks for joining the podcast today. Where do we find you today when we're recording this interview?
I'm in New York.
Yes. Okay. Well, I wanted to kind of give listeners who didn't get a chance to join us at the Awin event this May, I think it was. It's already over a month ago, I think, that you came and delivered the keynote presentation there. Could you give us a quick 101 on your career so far and a bit of an outline of what you do today?
Sure. So I've spent sort of 20 years analysing, understanding, explaining media, telecoms, technology, internet, e-commerce, retail, media, marketing, advertising. Was originally a sell-side equity analyst, worked in strategy at a couple of media telecoms companies, worked in consulting, spent 5 or 6 years in the Valley in venture capital, and I'm now sort of an independent analyst. So I write, I give presentations, I talk to people, I try and explain whatever the next interesting questions are.
Yeah, well, that was obviously one of the reason that we brought you into to our conference. And your presentation was titled The New Gatekeepers. And it talked a little bit about how there was a new set of companies, I guess, or business models at least, that have really usurped, for want of a better word, the old gatekeepers, largely thanks to this, I guess, the growing adoption of the internet and how that has really reshaped the nature of reaching consumers, both from like a marketing and a logistics perspective. But just to kind of get into definitions, how would you define what a gatekeeper is based on that presentation, and what really distinguishes these newer gatekeepers from the ones of the past?
Well, so I think there are always points of aggregation and points of gatekeeping. We have, whether you have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions, or effectively infinite product, you have a question of what is there to buy? What should you buy? How would you know about it? How would it get to you? How would it be distributed? What's the logistics? What's the discovery? And that might be a department store or supermarket. It might be a magazine or newspaper or TV channel. There are always points in a funnel where there are people who are making decisions about what they will and won't sell, what they will and won't advertise or tell you about or distribute. And that's been true for as long as we've had sort of an industrial economy.
And so, one of the things that you actually kind of focused in on was, at the very start, I think, was
highlighting this sharp reversal that we've seen in terms of the kind of economic conditions after the pandemic or post-pandemic, and now how that's forced a lot of businesses to reconsider their strategies and how they go to market. Now, you kind of titled that particular part of the section, the end of free money because of this rising inflation and interest rates we've seen. Given your venture capital kind of background, I wondered what you thought of how that's affected that particular space and particularly investment in tech businesses, and whether or not you think that we're now maybe living in a much more pragmatic or realistic world where those valuations maybe aren't as inflated as they once were.
Well, so there's several different things in that. So we went through the pandemic when everyone was shut up at home. And so we had an acceleration in adoption of a bunch of digital things, particularly video calling and e-commerce. And so the valuation of Zoom at one point was larger than the valuation of Exxon, which was obviously not very sensible even at the time. And we also had a spike in the adoption of e-commerce. And what's happened in most places is that e-commerce kind of got pulled forward 1, 2, maybe 3 years in early 2020, but then sort of continued at that level. And so the trend line has sort of caught up with it. And we are now more or less at the point that we would have been if the pandemic hadn't happened. The crucial part to understand that is we are at a point in which it was growing. It was growing fast in 2019. We basically got all the growth from 2019 to 2023 in 2020. And we're now kind of continuing upwards at that level. In the US, e-commerce is now sort of 20% of retail, depending on how you count it. In the UK, e-commerce is now 40% of non-food retail. And so, yes, we returned to the trend line, but the trend line is pretty aggressive. I think there's then a separate point, which is that we had 10 years of very low or zero interest rates, and we had 10 years of economic growth. And we had 10 years of increasing enthusiasm in what migration to digital would do. And particularly that then sort of got accelerated by that spike that we saw in 2020. And so we had kind of a period of loss of discipline, exuberance, overinvestment, particularly in sort of things that were predicated on free capital, but also in, sort of local food delivery and so on, but also more generally just in valuations for every kind of software company. And those, again, are sort of reverting to the norm. So, the Zoom market cap is back to probably a sensible market cap today, not that I'm an equity analyst anymore. And companies that were predicated on, an indefinite supply of free capital now have an existential problem. But that doesn't really affect the underlying fact that, 40% of UK non-food is online and people don't need to work. And I think a lot of the, as we sort of, how can I put this? We've had this sort of pendulum swinging back and forth. And so, pendulum swung very hard one way in the pandemic. It sort of swung back the other way. And we're kind of working out what the new point of equilibrium is. And so we don't all work from home all the time. But at the same time, we don't now all feel that we have to be in the office 5 or 6 days a week. You can now ask the question. You don't take all your meetings remotely, but you can also ask, do we need to spend an hour going across town to that meeting and then an hour in the meeting room and then an hour coming back? Or could this be a 15-minute video call? And so you can ask that question in a way that you maybe didn't ask the question in 2019.
Yeah. I think in reference to the kind of valuation aspect of that question, there's something quite interesting going on at the moment as well. You look at something like the NASDAQ, and I think there was reports just recently about the fact that it's kind of outperformed itself. It's got the best performance for the half year in the last 40 years. Do you think a lot of that is simply, and we'll kind of come back to the AI kind of topic a little bit later, but is that a consequence of this AI buzz maybe serving to inflate those stocks more so than they necessarily would be where they are today otherwise?
Well, so, sort of in the course of the sort of second half of last year, a bunch of technologies that had been kind of floating around as potentially interesting suddenly turned into something that worked in kind of radically dramatic ways. And so we now have a huge wave of excitement, investment, creation around generative AI, sort of the second wave of machine learning, I would say, second wave of machine learning that works. There have been sort of previous waves back in the 80s and 90s. And there's a huge amount of investment around that. Now, obviously, part of that investment is around the fact that generative AI is very capital intensive and very labor intensive. And so there's a huge amount of actual kind of money required to make anything, make sort of some of the lower levels in the stack work. There's also, I think, a kind of, and so we've had, very large funding rounds for a small number of companies and some a couple of very large deals already, large acquisitions already. There's also, I think, a little bit of a sort of question around like what is it that sits in between spending $1 billion buying GPUs on the one side, and on the other hand, writing 5 lines of code and doing, you know, a wrapper on ChatGPT on the other, which is probably not a path to a $1 billion company. There's a sort of, I think, a lot of sort of hesitance and kind of puzzlement around, well, what's the space in the middle between, you know, 3 people and 10 lines of code on one side and, you know, $5 billion worth of CapEx on the other. And so I think there's a lot of VCs and entrepreneurs are kind of sitting and scratching their heads and thinking, okay, well, how do you build an actual startup in this space? But stepping back from that, you know, we had a wave of AI that started in sort of 2013, 2014. And that became sort of central to how all software is being built. And I think the sort of base case around generative AI is this is another wave of investment that will reset how software gets created. Now, then there are obviously much more aggressive views than that as well, but that's just the base case.
Now, just to refer back to your presentation, one of the telling slides that you referenced actually illustrated the decline in share of US ad spend that newspapers were able to command over time. So it was down from close to about 80% in 1930. It went down to less than, I think, about 5% today, the kind of chart was illustrating. And in fact, that it's kind of less than Amazon now generates independently from its own kind of ads that it's obviously serving.
Globally, yes. Globally, Amazon had, I think, $40 billion in ad revenue last year, which is more than the global newspaper industry.
Yeah. I mean, it's a stark contrast in comparison. I think it really illuminates kind of where we are with where that ad spend is going. Do you think that like the newspaper ad model itself is just one that's fundamentally broken up because of the changes in consumer habits and how we get our content and our news and what we're familiarized with online? Or is there any way that actually these businesses can kind of claw back some of that income?
Well, the funny thing about talking about newspapers is there isn't really anything that you can say now that wasn't being said in 2010. Or arguably maybe 2005, which is, you know, you had an oligopoly of a certain kind of attention, which was based on physical assets of, you know, physical like manufacturing of this product and on the logistics of delivering it every day. And so that lent itself to a relatively small number of companies. In the US, 1 or 2, maybe 3 per metro area. In Europe, you know, something in the region of half a dozen, perhaps a dozen, depending on how you define newspaper, per country. And so as a consumer, that was the only way you could get that product. And as an advertiser, they had a kind of a monopoly, an oligopoly on a certain kind of reach. And where the internet breaks apart both sides of that. So consumer, suddenly you have vastly more options for things to read or things to be entertained or informed by. And as an advertiser, you have vastly more and often much more efficient ways of reaching a customer. I think one of the things that's happened, so it's sort of several moving parts within that. Firstly, something like 20% of Facebook revenue comes from 80% of the customer base, the advertiser base. So there is this sort of huge long tail of new kinds of advertisers that did not exist before or could not advertise before or could only advertise in very limited ways. So you sort of unlocked this kind of new market. Secondly, I think there's a lot of recategorization. So, you know, 1995, if you were a car dealer in the San Francisco Bay Area, you put a 20-page insert into the newspaper. And now you have a website that lists all your inventory and you buy search ads. And so you're not really in that chart of ad spend anymore. Your ad search ad is in there, but you know how many people are bidding for BMW dealers in San Francisco, like you and Mercedes and Audi, but that's it. So, you know, it's not a very expensive ad. And so there's money that, and you know, if you're in real estate, now your listings are on Zillow or StreetEasy, or in the UK, on a real estate aggregator in the UK, they're on Zoopla or, you know, Property Finder, Location Finder, or whatever it's called. And so there's a lot of stuff that was called advertising that now isn't called advertising. The economic activity moved into something with a different category, or it's been completely repriced, or both. And the other side of that, of course, is that if you're a brand, you are now asking, should we put our money into advertising on Instagram or YouTube or search, or should we put into free shipping, or should we put it into pricing or into Amazon ads, or should we put it into pop-up stores or into rent or into the retailer's margin or into our returns policy? So there's an awful lot of different ways that a brand spends money to get the product to the customer. You know, And those all sort of become interchangeable in ways that they weren't in the past. You know, in 1990, you couldn't ask the question, you know, should we advertise in that country or open source there? It wasn't like a sense of meaningful question. Now it is. You know, should we advertise on the East Coast or should we open stores on the East Coast or both? Well, that's now a question in a way that it wasn't before the internet. And so a lot of things that were sort of separate budgets in separate parts of an organization now kind of all become one budget. So this is sort of the narrative. Well, what's the TAM for Google? Well, the TAM isn't just advertising. The TAM is retail rent. Equally, I mean, you can look at Amazon, the Amazon ad business, which is, as I said, sort of $40 billion last year, and say, well, is that advertising or is that marketing? And certainly, if you ask where's the budget coming from, it's kind of both, you know, and or is it price discrimination? You know, is this a way for Amazon to get Procter & Gamble to give them more margin? And, you know, is this a way that Amazon lets the brands on the platform bid against each other for placement? Well, you know, we used to call that trade dollars and slotting fees. So is that advertising or is that marketing or is that something else? And the answer is, well, yes. And in many ways, all of that sort of traditional demarcation, you know, above the line and below the line, breaks apart or means different things.
Yeah, I guess my follow-up question to that is really, how does that change the dynamic between, if you've got budgets suddenly seeping out from these traditional channels that were quite siloed because you had a fairly good understanding of, you know, we need X amount to maintain our presence on the high street, we need X amount to maintain our kind of logistics and supply chains or our payment functions, and this is all for our marketing and advertising, and that's all starting to get quite kind of porous between those different silos now. Where does that leave, specifically from our perspective, I guess, and our audience's perspective, like marketing and advertising? Is that suddenly in this world of infinite media and infinite products where the central kind of thesis, I guess, of your presentation was about how do you reach your customers as an entity, as a business? Does marketing and advertising in that new world of these new gatekeepers become much more important, kind of similar importance as it was historically, or maybe less so?
So, I mean, there's sort of two kind of framing points, I think. One of them is that, you know, any brand, anyone trying to reach a consumer has two fundamental questions. There's a logistics question and a discovery question. How do I physically get the product? How do you serve the customer? And how does the customer know that you exist and want to decide that they want to buy the product? And so, you know, an Hermes boutique on Bond Street is doing both of those. It's a logistics experience and a discovery experience. A corner shop selling milk is a logistics experience. It's not really persuading you that you want milk. And, you know, IKEA is also doing both of those in a very different way to Hermes. You know, you walk around the store and there's all this stuff selling you the product. And at the end, you load it onto a cart and you take it home. And so you could do kind of a multi-dimensional scatter plot of how do people do this? And, you know, a life insurance company is somewhere on that scatter plot. And so is Milk. And so is IKEA and Hermes and Zara and all sorts of anyone trying to serve a customer is sort of managing and thinking about those two. And, you know, you're either giving up margin to an advertiser or you're giving up margin to a channel. And maybe the channel is both advertiser and is both an acquisition path and a discovery path. And the internet sort of changes that calculus and creates a new set of channels and a new set of options. And in many ways kind of merges the two of those into new and different ways. It creates the opportunity for many new brands to go direct. On the other hand, like, not all brands can go direct. Like, some people want to. Like, you know, if you are selling chocolate bars, should you be selling them direct to consumer? Maybe, maybe not. Like, but, you know, there's an awful lot of companies, an awful lot of consumer brands that were historically B2B businesses. So, you know, if you walk into the head office of a makeup company in Paris or New York and say, can I buy lipstick? Well, you'll get some kind of strange looks because they don't sell lipstick. They sell trucks full of lipstick. And now they ask, well, is that how it should be? And how does that change? Should we be building a customer relationship? And if you do, well, that's not a trivial thing to do. That's a completely different kind of business. You know, you've never met, you know, it's like I used to have these conversations with people in the pandemic. They say, well, you know, we're very happy with our ERP, but we've never shipped less than 10,000 units per order. And it turns out we can't. Or we actually can't. Now, the ERP cannot do that. The warehousing certainly can't do that. I mean, this is kind of what Walmart, when people like that were discovering 15 and 20 years ago, that they have this amazing logistics network, but the logistics network is based on stocking shelves in a store. It's not based on putting one product in a box and giving that to FedEx or UPS. So that's kind of one framing around this, is like logistics and discovery. I think the other framing is, as you sort of alluded to, that before the internet, you have sort of very basic physical constraints on how much inventory there can be and how much product there can be. Like, how big is a store? How much can you stock? never mind what inventory can you have, just how many products can you physically put in a store that makes any sense? And then you have a kind of a pair to that on the media side, which is like, how much inventory is there? Like, how many pages are there in Vogue? How many Saturday evening advertising slots are there on TV? And when you go to the internet, now you've effectively got infinite product and you've got infinite media. And so you no longer have that constraint of, well, there's only so many stores on Bond Street. There's only so many retail slots on Bond Street. There's only so many cookie brands in Selfridges or in Sainsbury's or Tesco or Walmart. There's only so many back pages of Vogue. There's only so many people who could do a nationwide TV buy. And those constraints, you have that kind of cliff of the kind of a binary question of, can you do physical retail or not? Now, how much physical retail or not? You want to do physical retail? Well, you're going to start with one store and then 10 and then 20 and so on. And that you don't have that cliff anymore. On the other hand, just because you don't have to have physical stores doesn't mean that all that money becomes margin. Like, if you don't have stores, you have to give all the money to Instagram.
Yeah. Well, this is the irony, I think, of a lot of the D2C brands. When that at first kind of emerged as a trend, and there was a lot of buzz around, well, you know, we can do away with that high street presence now. We can just throw money at social, do some targeted advertising, and we can just sell all our products through those channels digitally native. And yet it kind of culminated in a lot of these upstart D2C brands suddenly kind of buying up actual high street kind of presence in shops. And suddenly those shops actually, rather than becoming a transactional space, it felt like they actually became almost like it was like part of the brand awareness piece. It was like, oh, we've got a shop now. You can come in, you can feel our product, and you can talk to our kind of actual people face to face. And that then almost has this inverse value to what a shop traditionally might have represented for selling stuff, and was actually selling the brand, and it was about the experience.
Yeah. So, I mean, the kind of great case study of this is Apple Retail. I mean, Apple has, I think, 300 or 400 stores now. And there is no other company that has stores of that size in places with that rent per square foot. You know, traditional luxury goods companies pay the same rent per square foot very often, but not at anything like that size. And, you know, it's just, you're in central London or central New York or Paris or wherever. But nobody has that retail footprint of that size and that quality, which is also saying something about, well, what kind of product is it that Apple is selling? But, you know, until sort of 5 years ago or something, Apple broke out the financials for retail separately as a segment. They kind of changed the reporting, so it's now not reported separately. But from memory, it was something like 10, maybe 12% of revenue. And so the people were not buying phones in the stores. They were being sold them in the stores. The stores were basically a self-funded marketing operation. So the purchasing in the store was paying the rent, but the purpose of the store was not for you to make the purchase there. It was marketing. In fact, I think the vast majority of iPhone sales happens through the operator stores, through the phone companies. Yep. But the shop is still selling the phone.
Yeah.
And so kind of a good example, you know, exactly what you're talking about. Is the store the end point to a logistics chain, or is the store a marketing platform? And that there, you know, and how should that change? And how should that change depends on what you are. And it's back to my point about milk. A corner shop is probably the most, remains a very efficient way to get milk. On the other hand, IKEA is opening city center stores. In fact, the kind of the perfect parable here is when Topshop went bust. The UK audience will know all about. Topshop went bust, and the flagship space on Oxford Street, Oxford Circus in central London, has been taken by IKEA. And so the model is not that you're going to drive there and load a cart up with all of this stuff and wheel it out and load it into your car. The model is that you're going to go there and look at it and then make the order. Now, I don't actually know what the in-store order, I should know this, but you know, but the point is, it's not logistics anymore. They're separating the marketing and the logistics.
Yeah, we've had like a version of that open up not far from where I live in Southwest London, in Hammersmith, and it's in a central location. It's taken over basically a high street mall, and it's kind of 2-3 floors primarily of kind of places that you can kind of wander around and get inspiration for ideas of stuff that you would then obviously go onto IKEA's website and probably order.
Yeah, but I think that's kind of the perfect example of separating the logistics and the discovery. I mean, you see the same thing with, you know, the other part of Topshop is Shein. And so Shein did $30 billion apparently last year. This is the numbers that have been reported. And, you know, how many different ways is Shein unbundling things? Because obviously, you know, the purchasing experience is separate from the logistics, self-evidently. Secondly, what Shein is actually doing is aggregating Chinese manufacturers. So it's not their plants. And obviously, you know, any most retailers, most apparel brands don't have their own factories. They're ordering it from people. But what Shein is doing is sort of aggregating all of these short Chinese manufacturers that can do short run ordering. They would claim that they have substantial, even though they have, you know, substantial. So wind back a second. So Zara, I think, does 25,000 new products a year. And so Zara is this amazing operating model that they can do this turn in the inventory and turn in the product so quickly. Shein is fine. Well, before they stopped really giving the number on the app every day, it was sort of 10,000 new products every day. But that's all short-run predictive manufacturing. So they were claiming that it was actually less wastage than traditional fast fashion because they weren't buying a whole enough to put inventory in all the stores. Zara has 1,000 stores. So they have to have the inventory for that in some level. Shein doesn't have to have the inventory. They might make 50 or 100 of it and wait to see who buys it. And then it's shipped direct from the manufacturer. It's not going through their logistics. It's going from the manufacturer. So you're kind of changing the logistics model and changing the discovery model and the kind of the merchandising and the retailing model. It's an interesting pair with IKEA.
Yeah, yeah. There's a weird kind of take on Shein where you could almost say that they've disrupted the fast fashion industry by getting faster. But I guess they could even argue, as you've kind of suggested there, that it's a more sustainable approach as well, in the sense of not wasting production of product that is then not being bought.
Yeah. So I mean, I think you could kind of that. I mean, that's, you know, that's the point that they've made. I can't imagine. Yeah. I'm not an apparel person.
No.
And I think that's also an important point here. I mean, I think it's interesting to pair Shein with Netflix because, you know, on the narrow level, both Shein and Netflix are liberated from inventory constraints. So Shein doesn't have to put inventory in 1,000 stores. Netflix doesn't have a constraint on how many Saturday nights there are. So, you know, Netflix makes more TV shows, made more TV shows last year than the entire US TV industry did in 2005 when streaming was really just starting. So there's a very obvious kind of pair there. You are no longer constrained by that kind of physical inventory model, whether that's time slots or you know, inventory in a store. But the second point is that all of the questions that matter for Netflix are TV industry questions, like how many shows, what do you pay the stars, what are the royalty model, what's the rights model, you know, what kind of show should you make? Should you make films? Should you go for award? Like, I don't know. I don't even know what the questions are. Like, don't ask anyone in Silicon Valley, ask Ari Emanuel. It's a TV company. All the questions that matter are TV questions. And the same point, I think, applies to Shein. All the questions that really matter for Shein are apparel industry questions. Like sustainability. I don't know, ask an apparel person. Like, how much do people care? How does it matter? How sustainable is it? What does it mean? Are they using Uyghur cotton? Ask an apparel person. It's an apparel company. It's not a tech company. It's a company that's using software as a new channel. But that's kind of like looking at Walmart and saying it's a car company. Well, it's a company that presumes everybody has a car. But all the questions that matter to Walmart are retailing questions. You know, back to, you know, when it was the amazing growth company in the 70s and 80s. It's a retailer. It's a grocery company. Now, it's a grocery company with a new operating model. And it's a new operating model that's enabled by partly just a different operating model, different way of thinking about how you'll do this. It's also enabled by presuming that everybody has a car. It's enabled by the interstate highway system. But it's a retailer. It's kind of like looking at department stores and saying they're railway companies. Well, yes, but no. You know, or it's like it's like looking at Dell and saying it's a shipping company. Well, yeah, Dell presumes UPS and FedEx, for the sake of argument. But no, Dell is a computer company.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess it's thinking about the things that these companies are premised upon and what they take as their foundation. They can kind of scale up from there. And that kind of leads me back to thinking about advertising and where that industry lies today. Because I know at one point you were talking about, you know, how the internet's ability to really help companies scale globally and scale platforms to scale globally has led to there being just a few dominant players in industries like advertising. So I think you were saying about the ad spend of the top 100 advertisers in the world in 2021 was roughly equivalent to the ad revenue of the three dominant platforms of Amazon, Meta and Google or Alphabet. So do you think that there are any likely sources of disruption to this kind of stranglehold that those companies have, particularly over advertising right now? Or are they just so dominant now that it's difficult to really envisage where that could come from, with the caveat that maybe if I'd asked you that maybe 2 years ago with TikTok surging in popularity, we might have said that that does represent some kind of disruption, but there's a caveat around, I don't know, the geopolitical dynamic going on there. But
yeah, so maybe kind of two or three answers to this. One of them is, I kind of go back to what I said earlier. It's like, what's the TAM here? Is the TAM online advertising, or is it advertising, or is it everything that a retailer spends to reach its customer? Because if you add rent into that model, then that market share looks kind of different. Like, what is total retail rent for the retail industry, as opposed to what is advertising, or not just retail, but everyone who has a retail space, which isn't just, you know, physical retailers, it's banks and everyone else. What is total retail rent as a pair compared to what is total ad spend and total marketing spend? Well, it's roughly the same. Something over $1 trillion, certainly, globally. So that's one answer. Like, what's your market definition here? What is it that they have market dominance of? The second answer is that generally what happens in tech when you have a segment that has very strong network effects and winner-takes-all effects, and you have a winner in that segment, is that the competitive threat doesn't come from somebody doing the same thing but better. The competitive threat comes from someone doing something different. So, you know, if we were having this conversation in 2005, then we'd have been saying, well, obviously Facebook isn't going to work because Google's got all the data. Remember Google Plus?
Not really.
And the same applies to, as you say, TikTok, or indeed Snapchat. TikTok, and does TikTok compete more with YouTube or with Facebook? I mean, that's also an important question. Like, which market definition are you looking at here? Is this a social network? I would say TikTok competes much more with YouTube than it does with Facebook. Somehow YouTube has sort of escaped that narrative. So, and you know, do we think that like TikTok is the last thing that's going to happen in internet popular culture? Like, that seems like a really like silly thing to say. So, I mean, maybe kind of a different framing to take here is that, you know, I compare the internet to cars. I would also compare the internet to kind of mass media and popular culture. Snapchat is pop culture. TikTok is pop culture. And so this is sort of like being in like 1970 and saying, well, Rolling Stone has won music magazines. There's not going to be any more music magazines. Well, no. You know, Rolling Stones and the Beatles, they kind of won pop music, so that's it. Well, yeah, no, like, that's not how it works. That's not the right kind of mental model for looking at this. And so Snap kind of identifies like a new way that people want to feel and expresses that. And then TikTok, again, identifies a new way that people want to feel and expresses that. And so I tend to look at social media, quote unquote. I mean, I don't even know if social media is a particularly useful term anymore. But I would certainly look at Snapchat or Instagram or TikTok or YouTube as pop culture. And sometimes pop culture wave gets captured within it, which is sort of what happens within YouTube. But sometimes there are new forms of self-expression and new platforms and new ways that express how people want to feel. And you're sort of stepping back from this, Sheehan, you know, back to my what are you presuming? Sheehan presumes that all teenage girls have a smartphone. So when all teenage girls have a smartphone, what does that mean? You know, that means an awful lot of other stuff gets created too around that. I mean, there's like, what happens when teenagers have cars? What happens when teenagers are no longer, what happens when everyone has a radio? Like, what things come out of that? And I think that's sort of a good way of thinking about smartphones, that they are enablers for all kinds of popular culture and popular expression.
Yeah. I wanted to round off our conversation just by thinking about and where you, I guess, concluded the presentation itself was talking about AI. Obviously, there's been lots of buzz, lots of developments. It feels like there's something new happening in that space every single day at the moment. Thinking specifically about the forms in which we've seen it take so far, primarily ChatGPT, do you think the generative search interfaces that we've seen deployed so far are likely to change the way that people actually search for information online? And if they do, how does that new search model actually monetize itself? So is it ad slots? Is it licenses, subscriptions? Is it something else? Where do you see that going?
So several ways to think about this. So generative search was kind of a buzzy term six months ago. And, you know, in principle, you're going to go to Barcelona, Madrid, Milan, Athens in 2 weeks. What do you do? What hotel, what restaurants, what do you do when you're there? And so you go to Google, and some of your Googling will be searching for travel guides from Condé Nast or newspapers and magazines and what have you. Some of it will be searching specifically directly for particular things. and you'll have 30 tabs and you'll kind of accumulate notes and links and things. Or you go to ChatGPT and you say, what should I give me an itinerary for 3 days in Barcelona? And it just gives you the itinerary. And so this is what generative search is summoning up, that it actually creates the result to your search. And so you're not really searching anymore. You're asking a question and it generates an answer to your question. Now, several things come out of that. One of them is, I think, when people first started saying this, there was a sort of panic reaction that, oh my God, well, there won't be any ads anymore. And I think it should be fairly obvious that if I've just said I'm going to Barcelona for 3 days, you can have an ad there. Mm-hmm. Now, that ad might look different and get sold in different ways, but, you know, there's a call to action and a scope to make to suggest purchases there. The scope for disruption is to kind of maybe change how that works, but like that's still, there's still an ad there. Secondly, there was a sort of suggestion that this would be kind of a market reset and this would break the kind of default presumption that you go to Google. I think it's far too early to say that. I think it's pretty obvious that Bing fizzled out completely. In fact, I was looking, I've seen data that says that Google Bard is doing better than Bing, which is hilarious. So, and that's kind of a narrow kind of tactical point. But I think we also have to kind of step back and say, like, you go and you use ChatGPT and you think, oh my God, this is amazing. Okay, now go and ask it a question about something you know really well. So instead of saying, what should I do in Barcelona? Imagine you are the person that everybody asks for recommendations on what nightclubs to go to in London. Okay, go ask ChatGPT and look at it and see how much of it is bullshit. Sorry, can I say that on your podcast? Go and look at it. Whatever the field is that you know a lot about, like what are good hiking things in the Lake District? Like I would rather die than go hiking, but I know someone is doing that. Take a field you know a lot about, where you will know the answers, and then put that into ChatGPT, and you will see, oh, okay. So the experiment I did, because there's a lot about me on the internet, and obviously everyone is an expert in themselves, write a biography of Benedict Evans. So what I get is something that looks like a very, very good version of a biography of someone like me. So Benedict went to Oxford. No. Cambridge, no. Oxford, no. The LSE. His first job, he read history, no. English, no. History, no. Philosophy, no. Economics, no. History. His first job was in investment banking, no. Consulting, no. Investment banking, no. Consulting, no. He worked for The Guardian, no. He wrote for The Economist, no. He wrote for The Financial Times. And it's matching the pattern perfectly. Really important to understand this. It never says Anglia Poly or MIT or the Royal College of Art. It's never the wrong kind of university, the wrong kind of degree, the wrong kind of job. It's matching the pattern. And so what it's saying is, what would an answer to a question that looks like that look like? What kind of answers do people tend to produce to questions like that? And so there was a basic story that got a lot of publicity a couple of weeks ago where a lawyer had asked this thing for legal precedents, and it gave him stuff that looked like legal precedents. Courses weren't true. The courses hadn't happened. The case it's had in hand. And when you go and went and looked at the precedents that it had written, if you're actually a lawyer, you could see, wait a minute, this is gibberish. If you're not a lawyer, it looks like law to me. Like, I can't tell. And this is what people call hallucination or the error rate, or people say it's making things up. It's not making things up, it's matching a pattern. And so that means, ironically, the one thing you can't use it for is web search. Because you can't use it for things where you can't tell if the answer is correct and it matters. So if you're in marketing and you say, write me 20 ideas for a slogan, produce 100 ideas for what this ad would be. Give me 200 variants of an ad I can't remember which ad agency was that showed this as a case study in Cannes. They were working for a company in Latin America that has franchises of thousands of independent restaurants. Make social media ads for all these restaurants. So it makes 1,000 ads. You look at the ads. Okay, a quarter of them are terrible, like garbage, like gibberish. A quarter of them are real, but not very good. And half of them are good enough to use or pick up and edit. And the way that I always answer this is a very long answer to your question, but the way that I always used to talk about the last wave of machine learning was to say this gives you infinite interns. So listen to every call coming into the call center and tell me if the customer's angry. You don't need an expert in customer service for that. You just need like a 10-year-old. But you don't have enough. In fact, you just like a dog. I could train my dog to say, is the customer angry? Does the customer sound nervous? Your dog could do that. But you don't have enough 10-year-olds or interns or dogs to listen to a million calls a day. And so machine learning lets you automate that. And now machine learning gives you infinite interns on the other side. Write me 500 ideas for a slogan here. Write me 500 sample Facebook ads in 10 minutes. And then I'll go and look at them and see which 50 of them or 100 of them are really good. Okay, that's actually still really useful. But it's, again, what would you do if you had a million interns? What would you get them to do? And it's not do your job for you, but it's do something useful.
Yeah. I think we've just about run out of time. I've got a bunch of other questions I was going to ask you, but I think we're going to have to leave it there for now. But I want to thank you for taking the time to jump on the podcast and talk to me as a follow-up to the presentation. We'll be sharing a link to listeners that are interested to kind of check that out for themselves as well. And I definitely urge them to kind of subscribe to your newsletter and your own podcast, which I think that must be due a new episode of its own. No, you've got a new season coming up soon.
Deciding whether to keep going over the summer or take a break. But right, yes, there's a podcast, there's a newsletter. Just Google Benedict Evans. My parents had good SEO.
Perfect. Well, thanks again, Benedict. And I look forward to seeing your work in the future.
Thanks.
Huge thanks to Benedict for joining me there on the podcast today. He's really a very interesting person to speak to about technology trends. And as I mentioned earlier, his newsletter and podcast are well worth subscribing to for an insightful analysis of what's going on in the wider tech world right now, which is usually quite a lot. Now, if you're interested in seeing his AWIN keynote for yourself and that conversation whet your appetite, then head to the landing page for this episode where we've shared a link to the recording itself. And to finish off today, I just wanted to quickly do a roundup of some recent AWIN news that may be of interest to listeners. Now, while I was off, the updated version of the AWIN Report Power 100 for 2023 launched, featuring a selection of new partners and new case studies, which really brings that list to life. Just Google AWIN Report 2023 to find and download the latest version of our unique report. AWIN's think tank event in Berlin was a huge success just last month, as was the recently held US think tank, which was in Chicago. And combined together, these two events brought over, I think it was over 600 advertisers, agencies, affiliates and tech partners all together to network and find out more about the latest affiliate industry trends. Thanks to everyone that made it along to those conferences. And for any of you that didn't go and would like to check out a bit more about what happened there, the highlights articles are available on the blog right now. Staying in North America, we've just published our latest case study featuring a recent guest from the podcast. The Body Shop are a leading ethical retailer in the health and beauty sector, and they share more about their partnership with Student Price Card, which helped drive thousands of student sales in their physical stores in Canada. A really innovative and unusual approach to affiliate, which highlights how it can bridge that gap between digital and offline really successfully. I'll pop a link into that case study on the landing page for this episode, along with one to my recent interview with Natasha Phillips at the start of the year, who is the global head of affiliate and partnerships at The Body Shop, where she talks a bit about how she manages affiliate campaigns for a brand across the world. Now, I think that's probably enough for now today. If you've listened this far, thanks so much. It's good to be back. If you're enjoying the pod, then please do give us a rating, review, and subscribe. It all helps grow the word of mouth. In the meantime, I'll be back next month with another episode. Goodbye.